The French History Podcast is brought to you by Evergreen Podcasts. History, pop culture, news, whatever it is you're looking for, Evergreen has the best of it. Today's special episode is an interview with Dr. Matthew Yagel. Yagel is a diplomatic historian focusing on the United States and Southeast Asia during the Cold War. His academic monograph with Cornell University Press, Khmer Nationalist, Sun Nyuk-tan, the CIA, and the Transformation of Cambodia was the result of extensive research in various U.S. and overseas archivist buildings, including a year at the Cambodian National Archives on a Fulbright Fellowship. It examines the career of Cambodian nationalist Sun Nyuk-tan, his influence on the growth of nationalism in Cambodia, and his relationship with the United States. He has also written about the role of the Philippines in the war in Vietnam. He is currently instructor of history at St. Xavier University and co-host of the podcast Napalm in the Morning, The Vietnam War Through Film. Our episode covers the first part of his book, which details the history of the French colony of Cambodia. An oft-overlooked part of the French Empire, Cambodia was the regional breadbasket that furnished French troops in Vietnam. It was also a land of great prestige for whoever held it, given its historic temples, with Angkor Wat being the most famous of them all. In what follows, Yagel explains how France conquered, lost, retook, and finally lost once again this Southeast Asian country. Why she has been forgotten. Thank you very much for being on the show, Dr. Yagel. You have a very interesting and very niche topic. You talk about specifically Cambodia. Now, when most people think about conquered territories within the global French Empire, they think about Haiti, Algeria, Vietnam, and maybe Syria, and probably Senegal thrown in there for more of the historians. Your book deals with an oft-overlooked part of the French Empire, Cambodia. What led you to write about Cambodia and its struggle for independence?
Sure. Thanks very much. I was raised by, loosely, we'll call them hippies, who my parents came of age kind of during the war in Vietnam, and that kind of culture, music, film, etc., was kind of just always a sort of a thing that was just sort of around when I was kind of growing up. My dad went to high school in Japan during the war as well. And so that was always kind of a sort of a thing in the background. And so when I was going to school, kind of thinking about projects, things I'm interested in, this time period, I'm interested in kind of the role of the United States in Asia, in Southeast Asia. You know, Vietnam, a lot of great work has been done on that. What's maybe a diversion that maybe is related, but is also in some ways more new and less looked at? And so that brought me to Cambodia and being a graduate student at Northern Illinois University. We have the Center for Southeast Asian Studies there, which is Title VI from the Department of Education, you know, one of the very few in the world that has such a focus and has the language for Khmer, which is very rare to have. And so that gave me a lot of resources, a lot of great professors, Ken Clymer as well, who's written quite a bit on Cambodia. And so I felt like I had a good springboard to go off of for diving deep into Cambodia and the United States and what that relationship was like, roughly speaking, the period Second World War up until 1975.
Let's set the stage a bit. Can you explain some of the basics, such as why France conquered Cambodia in 1863, what Cambodia meant for France, how France initially administered the territory, and then what Cambodia was like under French rule.
Sure. So Cambodia, the Khmer Empire, was kind of, you know, for hundreds of years, really the jewel of Southeast Asia, really prominent, powerful empire, most famously with Angkor Wat in Siem Reap. And that empire kind of slowly began to kind of crumble and was eventually crushed in 1431, and sacked by Thailand. And after that, Cambodia suffered a continued decline over the next several centuries, really losing territory to, on the west side, Siam, on the east side, Nguyen Dynasty, kind of becoming more powerful in Vietnam. And so following the establishment of a French colony in Cochin, China in 1862, it was actually an outreach on the part of the Cambodian King Norodom to request that France establish a protectorate there, to kind of fear that Cambodia is going to be swallowed up by its neighbors on both sides. And so a resident general would have most power in Cambodia in the protectorate. Under the agreement, the monarchy would remain. France would really be in charge of kind of the economy, trade, foreign policy, foreign relations, military, things of that nature. But France makes an agreement with Siam to sort of cede the western provinces of Battambang. Battambang is in Cambodia. It is kind of touches Thailand on the west. And Siem Reap, which is sort of a northwestern province, that's where many of the famous Angkor temples are, including Angkor Wat. And so that agreement is made. France, it sort of seems like, okay, we've got this plan set out. Cambodia, in theory, is happy because they're not going to be swallowed up. France is happy because they have this buffer state in between what they're most concerned with, which is Cochin, China, and Thailand. Well, Siam, excuse me, at the time. And so, in theory, that's at the outset the idea. And these provinces, there is a war, Franco-Siamese war. The provinces, these are going to switch back a few times, so you have to attempt to keep track. But Battambang, Siem Reap switch back following, they are ceded back to the Cambodian protectorate following the French victory there. But these kind of border issues there, this is one of the staples of my full book. These tensions that exist between Cambodia and Siam, later Thailand, those are going to continue on for a lot of the rest of the story. In this sort of earlier era, Cambodia is not seen as important as Vietnam. There were, you know, attempts to introduce French language in schools, French culture. It is not to the same extent that you see in Vietnam. Education levels or lack thereof, it's probably one of the reason that there are fewer sort of nationalistic sort of outbursts than you might see in Vietnam, for example. But similar to what we see in Vietnam, many of those that did receive higher education, they study in France, they return to Cambodia, and they may have some of these more hardened nationalistic pride aspirations. You know, they've learned about things like self-determination and democracy and stuff like that, and they sort of bring these ideas back to them. So back with them, excuse me. So yeah, that's kind of sort of setting the stage, I think, for the rest of the story.
Certainly enough. For the next part, you write briefly about how France conquered Cambodia in 1863 and almost immediately faced resistance. The following year, Buddhist monks led the first great uprising, which failed, though long afterwards, Buddhist monks were crucial to the anti-colonial movement. Why were these indigenous holy men a core of the anti-French struggle?
Yeah, so there's the first and second great uprising, the second great uprising, roughly 20 or so years after the first one. Largely, those are in response to a growing French attempts to assert power, Governor General being really the most powerful figure in the Protectorate, attempts to reduce the power of the king. You know, the first one has to do with kind of issues of taxation and things like that as well. But throughout this, monks were and are revered figures in Khmer society. And so, therefore, they could command a degree of following. So while the, for example, first great uprising happens very quickly after the Protectorate is sort of established, you know, it is not in any ways successful, but it is maybe a glimpse into sort of what is to maybe come later. I would say that these are kind of initial sporadic periods of revolt that on the whole are fairly minimal. And it's not until you get to the 20th century that in many ways via Khmer monks, that a more nationalist Khmer form of both Buddhism and resistance is kind of conceived.
Your book focuses on one central figure, Son Nyok Tan. Can you talk about Tan's background and his experiences both in France and as part of French-controlled Cambodia?
Sure, and you may notice that his name is not a Khmer name. It is a Vietnamese name. He is born in Cochin, China, in Travin province. He is half Khmer, half Sino-Vietnamese. He is part of, born in 1908, so he's part of this French colonial slash protectorate empire in Indochina. And, you know, he has, I would say it seems like he has a relatively decent upbringing in terms of, you know, economic stability. He is able to go to schools. He studies in France. He returns from France, much like I was sort of hinting at before, with, I think, some of these ideas sort of percolating in his head, more nationalistic sort of ideas. He works in various sort of jobs, you know, as a prosecutor and various things, but he works at the Buddhist Institute, which is founded in Phnom Penh, the capital in Cambodia. And it is there that it's kind of through that he starts this sort of outreach, this sort of more nationalistic looking outreach. And one of the vehicles for doing that is the establishment of Nagaravata, which is a political newspaper, basically, which circulation grows fairly quickly to over 5,000. And it is there that he is sort of pushing this sort of nationalistic Buddhism, Khmer Buddhism, these sort of ideas, pushing them out there. He is really attempts to kind of work with the laity, the monk population, to kind of searching out who is maybe on board, a more of a nationalistic sort of sentiment, use them as vehicles for recruitment into these ideas. And so, you know, it starts small. Over time, he becomes more, let's say, problematic for French officials in Phnom Penh. And he's kind of bussed around and kind of, you know, sent to sort of an outer province at a certain point to kind of get him out of the capital. But even there, he kind of continues through these Sithawat schools, as they're known as, to kind of where he's, again, continuing to recruit. And this is going to sort of continue. But, you know, at this point, we're in the mid-late 1930s. And this is kind of as the Second World War is approaching us here. So things are going to kind of ratchet up, I guess, once that begins.
Central to the Cambodian nationalist movement was the Japanese conquest of Southeast Asia in World War II. The Cambodian experience defies the Western idea of the Axis forces as a totalitarian force crushing all other countries and indigenous peoples, while the Allies supposedly represented freedom and democracy. Many Cambodians, Tan among them, welcomed Japanese incursion as a liberating force against Western imperialism. Can you explain the complex relationship between Cambodians and Japan?
Sure, and it is an interesting one, and it's also a tricky one. I mean, this idea of Asian for Asians, the greater East Asian co-prosperity sphere, this is the sort of Japanese concept that they're sort of pushing out there. It is really more, from the Japanese perspective, more concerned with economic sufficiency than colonial liberation. So if you're an average Khmer peasant, I'm not sure how much these concepts mean to you. I'm not sure how much you're hearing about them. Much of the rhetoric is central to, however, Sun Yat-sen's writings during this period. And he kind of uses that rhetoric as a means to attempt to gain more power for removing French from Cambodia. So, I mean, that's his idea. That's his goal. I think to him, it's a means to an end. It is not clear how much of this is like quote unquote true believer talk on the part of Sun Yat-sen versus maybe political expediency. I think it's a little muffled there, but you know, he organizes this protest. A monk is defrocked and jailed, and Sun Yat-sen orders a massive protest in response to this that is done by the French. And his hope is that Japanese officials are going to kind of swoop in and join this massive protest in front of the colonial residents and kind of remove the French from power. And that does not go exactly as planned. And so Sun Yat-sen is sort of forced into hiding. He heads to Battambang briefly, then over to Bangkok. And from there, he is subsequently swifted away to Tokyo, where he lives under an assumed identity. And he's there for over 2 years. The uprising is the Revolution of the Umbrellas, as it's known, is in mid-42, and he goes to Japan at the beginning of 1943, and so he'll be there until May of 1945. But he, you know, there are writings he has with correspondence with followers back in Cambodia, and he is kind of, you know, referencing a lot of these ideas and concepts. Now, I mean, you know, again, the experience in you know, Cambodia is different than other colonial locations. So, you know, the Cambodia one, Japan is a little more hands off than in other places. But yeah, it's the Second World War. It's interesting that there's so much, you know. There's libraries worth of books written about the Second World War. You know, there's a lot to say about it. And this is, there's a lot to say about Cambodia as well.
Cambodia during World War II was in a strange place. On the one hand, Japan exercised nominal hegemony, given it was the great military power in the region. However, its officials lacked the linguistic and cultural expertise to administer Cambodia, and so they left the French officials in place. Did the French still exercise any real power, and how did this impact Cambodians?
So after experiencing some, let's call them administration issues, I guess, if you will, for lack of a better phrase, in Malaya and Java, Japan decided that, you know, sort of nominal day-to-day activity, day-to-day operations, they'll be led by the Vichy French operatives. Japan, they set up some kind of military outposts and barracks and things like that in Cambodia. But sort of the day-to-day, in theory, is going to be headed up by the Vichy French. Late 1940, you know, Thailand, they see, hey, France, they've just been defeated in Europe. Japan has moved in. They're in a pretty weakened state. This might be a great opportunity to retake. Here we go with our ping-ponging back and forth, these provinces in Western Cambodia. So that leads to the Franco-Thai War. And Japan kind of acts as a sort of a mediator during this, brings it to a ceasefire between the two. So France, I don't know. I'm not sure if they technically lose the war, but they lose Battambang, Palin, Siem Reap provinces, where, again, Angkor is located, Brivihia, others. So the loss of these territories could be spun to, I think, drive a wedge maybe between the local population and the French. That is a Japanese goal on in their various European colonies. You know, let's drive a wedge between the colonized power that we are either supplanting or working with in the case of Vichy France. I think that's a secondary to, you know, resource exploitation in support of the war in China is kind of their number one goal. That's their number one motivation. And in a lot of places, I think less so in Cambodia, but, you know, especially in, you know, the East Dutch East Indies or Indonesia, you know, the experienced war under the Japanese for your average local person is a, while the rhetoric is liberation, Asia for Asians, Greater East Asia, Crow Prosperity Sphere, the reality for a lot of people on the ground is a even more brutal existence than it often was in these colonized places.
Eating well is living well, and there's no easier way to eat well than with Factor. Factor delivers fresh, never frozen, chef-crafted meals that are ready to eat in just 2 minutes. They have many options, such as Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie, perfect to fit any diet. In addition to their main courses, they also provide snacks and wellness shots, a personal favorite of mine. With premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, and truffle butter, they have a wide range of dishes that will keep you satisfied throughout the week. Head to factormeals.com/FrenchHistory50 and use the code FrenchHistory50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's FrenchHistory50 at factormeals.com/FrenchHistory50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Sign up today. Your stomach will thank you. Japan's defeat in August 1945 dealt a terrible blow to Cambodian independence as French forces returned. Why was France determined to retake Cambodia, and how did it do so?
So, yes, Japan, I guess, wink, wink, nod, nods, and gives the green light for independence to be declared in March of 1945. And so it is, and that lasts until October of 1945. I mentioned earlier Sun Yat-sen returns in May. He returns as the foreign minister and then later assumes the role of prime minister in Cambodia. So for that occurs in August. So for what does he have? Roughly 2 months serving in the job. He is prime minister of an independent Cambodia. But that does not last long. The British forces and French return, and Sun Yat-sen is kind of whisked away. He is put on trial in Saigon, and then he's sentenced to 20 years house detention in France, where I don't think he lived a super rough life, but he was out of the picture in many ways. Why is France determined to retake Cambodia? I mean, restoring the jewel of its empire. You know, this is the home of Angkor Wat. You know, this is a place that at these sort of colonial exhibitions that they will recreate to show the world sort of the stunning majesty of its great, more broad empire. So to do this, you know, province promises a more agency within the broad French Union. There are political parties that are active in drawing up and drafting a new constitution, which those actually left the power of the monarch somewhat ambiguous, which would become maybe an issue later. But more control by Cambodians over day-to-day life. By 1950, Cambodia, Laos, and the three provinces of Vietnam, Cochinchina, Annam, and Tonkin, are recognized as independent states within the French Union. And so France is, hey, we want to take this back. We want to restore our former glory, but we realize that, and maybe with some prodding by other nations, we need to allow some semblance of agency and, you know, some semblance of independence maybe within the more broad French Union, if that is going to happen.
Can you talk about the Cambodian independence movement and how this country eventually won sovereignty?
So this is a long, long time coming, something Sun Yat-sen had been agitating for since, you know, the 30s. In a post-World War II world, Sun Yat-sen is not there. His political followers, a lot of them form the Democrat Party in Cambodia. Many other ones are part of this really broad group called the Khmer Issarak, which the Issaraks are, could encompass, you know, really left-wing Maoist, you know, guerrillas, or more conservative, like Sun Yat-sen, right-wing elements. The Issaraks is more of a broad blanket term for them, but they are agitating from the Maquis, from the jungle, and agitating against Norodom Sihanouk, who is in charge in Cambodia. He is king in Cambodia, and he is seen as being too close to the French, too pliable, you know, and not agitating enough for independence. And so, you know, I argue in the book, Sun Yat-sen, he is one way Sihanouk kind of to, in a way to tamp down some of this agitation against him. Hey, let's bring Sun Yat-sen back from France. And, you know, maybe the good graces, his political followers will see this sort of outreach, and Sun Yat-sen returns and there's 200,000 people waiting for him and banners, or, you know, he's sort of recognized as sort of this big leader for the independence movement. And his time back in Phnom Penh is very brief. I believe it's just a couple of months. And then he is, again, he's agitating at this time with Sihanouk. Sihanouk is not, in Sun Yat-sen's eyes, pushing hard enough for independence. And so Sun Yat-sen, he flees, and then he agitates from the jungle, from the Maquis. And I argue that Sihanouk is relatively speaking slow adopter of a lot of the positions that Sun Yat-sen has been pushing for, but he does adopt them. And by, you know, 1952, 1953, he is firmly ensconced in pushing the country toward independence. And he goes on this sort of tour, you know, of sort of Western provinces, this royal crusade of independence. You know, and he says, I'm not going to return until the French give assurances that full independence is going to come to Cambodia. And he goes on kind of the self-imposed sort of exile. And there's actually some really, really great video footage of him sort of staged, but, you know, kind of walking, you know, waist deep through rivers and things like that with this kind of group promenading behind him and all this stuff. It's quite interesting. But, you know, long story short, it eventually works. I mean, France has so much going on with their neighbor to the east in Vietnam, you know, the first Indochinese war, that it just seems sort of untenable to continue. And they get independence in 1953. That is fully recognized on November 9th, 1953.
Looming in the background of these events is the United States. As the world superpower, U.S. officials wanted to exert their influence across the world, yet they were in a bind. On the one hand, they wanted a strong France to act as an ally in Europe, but on the other, they feared that imposing colonialism on indigenous peoples would prove unpopular. Can you explain how U.S. officials dealt with this complex geopolitical situation?
Sure, and it is complex. And I think U.S. perceptions of colonialism broadly, French colonialism in particular, changed quite a bit with the passing of Roosevelt in 1945. Roosevelt is against, for the most part, returning to the pre-war status quo. You know, the big three, Stalin, Churchill, and Roosevelt, a lot of their discussions, you know, at Yalta are around a post-war, what's a post-war world going to look like? you know, Churchill is very much against giving up any colonies, British colonies, but he doesn't think any, you know, France or the Dutch or anyone should have to give up their colonies. And Roosevelt very much pushing for that. Roosevelt's very, very much against the, in his eyes, the sort of ineptitude of French colonialism. You know, you're supposed to be there as a protectorate of these people, and you've completely failed, right? Japan has swept in, taken over. So you had one job, as they say. So that, as I said, that kind of switches and changes after his death. Truman following up is less hardcore than Roosevelt is in that manner. So I think for the United States, they see it as the war ends, and we're kind of, it's France has made known their intentions to that they want to return, that hey, let's thwart a potential communist influence, provide some sort of semblance of a path to self-governance. That's going to be the best way to sort of thwart this. So that's a lot of what the United States is pushing for during this period, the kind of period, you know, in the 40s as we go into the early 1950s. So yeah, it's complicated. I think the fact that the United States does not have a lot of experts on the ground, it creates a lot of sort of chaotic analysis, sometimes incorrect analysis of the situation on the ground. But hey, a stable France in Europe is essential to a post-war world. And if one of the ways we're going to get that stability is by, okay, giving the nod to a French return to Indochina, then we're going to do it. So that's something that the United States is dealing with and attempting to kind of navigate there. So there's an interesting kind of correspondence sort of detailing maybe the confusion between France, the United States on some of these issues. The United States ambassador to France, Jeffrey Caffrey, met with de Gaulle in March of 1945. And in this meeting, de Gaulle kind of expresses he's sort of perplexed by these sort of U.S. refusals to, you know, in this instance that they're discussing, there he wants Britain to allow the British to transport French reinforcements to Indochina. And so I'm going to just quote briefly from de Gaulle from this. We do not understand your policy. What are you driving at? Do you want us to become, for example, one of the federated states under the Russian aegis? When Germany falls, they will be upon us. If the public here comes to realize that you are against us in Indochina, there will be a terrific disappointment. Nobody knows to what that will lead. We do not want to become communist. We do not want to fall into the Russian orbit, but I hope that you do not push us into it. So it is that fear, that kind of the quote unquote red menace, which, you know, it's already poking up its head in 1945. And I think that's something that the United States in Cambodia and in Indochina broadly and in France itself in Europe is fearful of. And so I think that de Gaulle quote kind of speaks a lot about that situation.
Your book is incredibly rich, and the chapters concerning the French interactions with Cambodia only make up the first part. What can readers expect from your work once Cambodia moves to a post-French existence?
Sure. After independence, things get in some ways more complicated. we have the Cold War sort of rushing in, and this is maybe the second, the last two thirds of the book are more focused on this. And a lot of that brings in the United States relationship with Cambodia and how that changes during this post-World War II Cold War era, how it changes under different presidencies, how it changes over time, and in response to the war in Vietnam, which is kind of growing and growing as an issue. So Cambodia, they are ostensibly neutral during the war. Nordam Sihanouk may have had his leanings toward the communist side, that in terms of international communism, but within Cambodia, he is extremely harsh and brutal against communists within Cambodia itself. So the United States is attempting to sort of navigate this. So, you know, you get, it's the 1950s, Eisenhower very fond of using subterfuge in the CIA and spies and things like that to kind of get a job done that he wants done. You know, we see it in Guatemala, we see it in Iran, we see an attempt in Cambodia in 1959. So my book attempts to dive into that, the attempted coup. Sun Yat-sen is a player in that failed coup attempt against Norodom Sihanouk. Sihanouk is not seen as kind of pliable. He is seen as too friendly to Vietnam, North Vietnam, Ho Chi Minh. We see a break in relations between Cambodia and the United States in the 60s. We see a resumption of relations in 1969 as the war in Vietnam is kind of peaking in 1968-69. We see the United States again moving toward, hey, maybe this could be an opportunity. I think there are the coup that unseats Sihanouk in 1970. My book details that and the role of the United States in that overthrow. And there's a lot going on there. And that ushering in the Khmer Republic, which is in some ways good. H.R. Haldeman's diary from following the overthrow of Sihanouk said that it was all right with us, his diary entry for that day. So we have Lon Nol coming into power, and you know, all his ineptitude, incompetence, and the trying to lead this Republican government while civil war is breaking out in Cambodia, failing in war, corruption in government. Sun Yat-sen is this sort of figure that is in the shadows for a lot of this. He's also a figure that returns to government in 1972 and again is prime minister in 1972. So it's kind of, in some ways, a return to power. His goal, remove the French and remove the monarchy, remove Sihanouk, is finally realized in 1970. So it's kind of his lifelong dream. And he kind of comes back and has a brief period where he returns as prime minister for about, 8 months or so. And then he is kind of ushered off into retirement, where he goes back to his home in southern Vietnam, where he's originally from. I mean, there's so much to the story. His recruitment of Khmer Sarai figures from southern Vietnam that are ethnically Khmer that live in Vietnam, having them agitate against Sihanouk, having them form the brunt of the army for the Khmer Republic in 1970 in the civil war against the communist Khmer Rouge. You know, there's a lot of moving parts. My book attempts to make this, I think a lot of it is foggy and cloudy, attempts to clarify a lot of this stuff. There's a lot of moving parts there. So if you're interested in not just the French era and the French period, but, you know, kind of a wider look at the war in Vietnam, the role of the United States, and not just focusing on Vietnam itself, but there's a lot of other things going on at the same time. And the destabilization of Cambodia is certainly part of this, and how that kind of paved the way in many ways for the Khmer Rouge to assume power in 1975, and the tragedy that followed. My book does not focus on that in great detail, but it is, my book kind of focuses on a lot of the pieces that lead up to that. So yeah, there's a lot to take in, but it was a fun experience researching and writing, and a rewarding one. So I hope people can get something out of it for sure.
The book is Khmer Nationalist Sun Yat-sen, the CIA and the Transformation of Cambodia. Dr. Yagle, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. It was great.
As always, donations keep the podcast going, so if you would like to make a one-time donation or become a patron, please consider doing so. Thank you very much for your continued support.
The Battle of Waterloo was one of the most famous turning points in world history. But what happened next? My name's David Montgomery, and I'm the host of The Siecle, a history podcast that tackles exactly that. Join me as I cover France's overlooked century in between Napoleon and World War I. The Siecle, spelled S-I-E-C-L-E, is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network and can be found wherever you get podcasts.